things these days, one about core curriculum, but even more often one hears complaints about teaching. I think you should know that our speaker has won a series of awards for his teaching, among other things. He received the Innovative Teaching Award when he was at Washington State University, and he's had the Professor of the Year Award at American University. So whatever you have to say against American teaching, well, you can reserve for some of the rest of us. he received his bachelor's degree from the University of Oregon and his doctorate from Indiana University. He's a professor at American University today and has served in a variety of capacities involving organized efforts to deal with governance in the budget process. For instance, he was co-director of the U.S. Senate Temporary Select Committee to study the Senate committee system. He served on a variety of American Political Science Association committees. He's published the book Setting Course, A Congressional Management Guide, and a whole series of articles and papers on such subjects as an empirical analysis of nuclear power plant organization and effects on safety, congressional budget reform and new demands for policy analysis, issues facing the four analytic support agencies of Congress, and impact of party recruitment upon legislative role orientations. He's kindly agreed to participate in our governance series and has framed his discussion of proposals for change in their evaluation under the general heading of governance and the budget process. Jim Thurber has been a helpful participant in several other programs we've had here, including a session we had with Chase Untermyer, the Director of Personnel in the Bush administration, on questions of presidential transition. So we're very grateful to him for making the trip down. I've learned from bitter experience that it's better not to pass papers out until after the speech, but there are copies of a paper he has done that I think you'll find very interesting.
Thank you very much. You did thorough research on my resume. I've never had such quite a lengthy introduction. Thank you very much. It's a real honor to be here at the Miller Center. It's a well-known center in Washington, D.C., and attracts well-known public officials and academics, and I feel honored to be part of that group. And I appreciate the opportunity today to talk about an issue that's in the press today. In fact, the Washington Post today says, Mitchell says, he's the majority leader of the Senate, as you know, White House is trying to impede deficit cut pact. We will probably go into a sequestration this year, according to my inside sources, and I'll explain exactly what that means for military expenditures, social expenditures, and for governance generally later. But first, let me remind you a bit about the history of Congress and the budget process. The Constitution clearly grants Congress the power to control the purse strings, as we know. And in fact, James Madison declared, this power over the purse may in fact be regarded as the most complete and effectual weapon with which any Constitution can arm the immediate representatives of the people for obtaining a redress of every grievance and for carrying into effect every just and salutary measure. Federalist Paper number 58. The Constitution clearly defines the role of the Congress as having the power of the purse, but it does not prescribe the type of budget process that it will adopt. Those come from statutes and internal rules and norms to a certain extent. And in fact, if you look at the history of Congress, it's been quite dynamic in terms of the relationship between the President and Congress over the budget process. And what we're experiencing today has been experienced historically in the past. Again, a bit of history. Until the Civil War in the United States, jurisdiction both over authorization of programs and appropriation of monies for programs were basically in the Appropriations Committee, in the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives and in the Finance Committee in the Senate. And we are used to sort of a three-ring circus at this point, as some people call it. We have authorization committees, we have appropriation committees, and now we have the budget committees as a result of the reforms in 74. Some, including Alice Rivlin, an economist at Brookings, who used to be the director of the Congressional Budget Office, says we've got to get rid of one of the three rings. We started with one ring. We started basically with committees with a great deal of power up to the Civil War. After the Civil War, because there were demands upon social expenditures, expenditures beyond the military area, expenditures for veterans primarily, and because life became much more complex, the growth of committees and the power of committees became more dispersed in the House and the Senate. And in fact, these committees, the committees of Ways and Means and Finance, really dominated things until 1865 in the House and in 1867 in the Senate, when appropriations committees were created. So it split jurisdiction, and then there was the growth of authorization committees. And in fact, it expanded as we entered into the 20th century, and when we entered into the 20th century, it doesn't seem like it now, but Congress became very concerned about controlling costs. We became, post-World War I, we became very cost-conscious, and we passed the 1921 the Budget and Accounting Act that created BOB, the Bureau of the Budget, and gave the President the power to oversee the expenditures of agencies and departments. These agencies and departments previous to this had a life unto their own. Not that they don't now, but they were very independent of the President. And this was the first centralization of power in the budget process in the presidency. The next major act that came along, besides in 1970, the name was changed to the Office of Management and Budget, but besides that, the next major act to come along to change the process significantly, and it really was somewhat of a revolution, was the 1974 Budget Empowerment Control Act. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the reasons why that act were passed, or at least the perceived reasons, the perceived problems, and what was passed in the act to solve those problems. And then I'd like to talk about what's happening today and some of the proposals for further reform that are active on Capitol Hill. And then I'd like to open it up to questions and answers after briefly going through those points. First of all, the problems that existed pre-1974 might sound very familiar. Let me go through some of them at this point. First of all, members of Congress were very concerned about the deficit and the debt. The deficit and the debt, and we'll get back to that later. Secondly, Congress felt it had no ability to set spending priorities the way we do in our lives. Certain stages in your life, you save money for a home and you defer expenditures on something else, and later you save money for education, and then you spend it later, and you set priorities. Congress felt that it had no way to set priorities over all the entire budget because it had individual authorization committees and appropriations committees that established their own spending guidelines. They simply added up what was appropriated and authorized, called it a budget. Revenue committees had to absorb what the appropriations and authorizations committees did, and usually there was a deficit, in other words, a lack of funds to pay for expenditures in that one year, and they'd pass a budget in the end that piecemeal that had a deficit, and they felt they had no control over this. Another problem was that Congress had little ability to determine and implement economic policy. Not that they can now, but they felt that they needed to implement some kind of economic policy, especially vis-a-vis President Nixon during this period. He was calling Congress big spenders, and Congress wanted to be able to fight back, but it was balkanized, the power was decentralized, and it was very difficult to come forward with one economic package to confront the president at this time. The revenue committees conducted their work with little regard for the work of the spending committees. Another problem that was perceived at the time was that Congress didn't have enough time to complete its work. Does that sound familiar? They had a series of years where they had continuing resolutions, CRs. Some years they didn't pass a single one of their 13 appropriations subcommittee bills on time. The then HEW, Health, Education, Welfare budget went for four straight years on continuing resolutions, primarily because of controversies around the question of abortion or controversies around the question of money for Medicaid or Medicare or some other specific thing that would hang up the bill. So they felt that they needed to do something about this, because basically what they had to do was appropriate all the money for all of the programs between around January 15, when the president came forward with his budget, and July 1, the old beginning of the fiscal year. So they tried to fix it. We'll talk about how they tried in a second. Another problem was that Congress lacked, pre-1974, an independent source of detailed budget information. They could not get the computer tapes from OMB. They could not get information out of the agencies. They did not have a way of independently judging the accuracy of the data coming out of the agencies. They did have the General Accounting Office, but it was primarily an office, an analytic support agency of Congress that oversaw the way money was spent rather than looking at the proposals coming to Capitol Hill. They were trapped. They were dependent upon the agencies primarily and interest groups on the outside for information about the budget. They had to rely upon OMB analysis that was prepared for the president. Some would say that OMB analysis, even though those individuals are known for their professionalism and objectivity, sometimes reflects the will of a president in terms of what the president wants in terms of analysis. So Congress wanted something separate. Congress also had great difficulty pre-74 imposing fiscal discipline on committees with legislative authority. Frequently, an authorization committee, let's say the Public Works Committee, would authorize a program for $500 million without regard to how much money was around, and the appropriations committees then were known as people who would cut back. They would come forward with an appropriation bill that would be $250 million. Now, that isn't a lot of money these days, but in those days it was. And the level of authorization many times was 50% above the level of appropriations. They wanted to do something about this, bring them down more closely, bring discipline to the institution. Congress also had no procedure to overcome presidential impoundments. And as you remember, President Nixon, in 1973, at the height of the environmental movement, impounded $8.1 billion worth of water treatment funds, classic pork barrel funds that Republicans and Democrats alike love to take home to their constituents so they can get votes and get reelected. These funds, on an aside, were authorized by the Public Works Committees and passed by Congress. The President signed these into law. Then the appropriations subcommittees dealing with public works appropriated the necessary money. It passed easily went to the president. The president vetoed these funds. It went back to Congress. He overrode the veto. And then it went back to the president. And at this point, he refused to spend it. Now, this is called a presidential impoundment. Now, impoundments, all of you know, have been going on since George Washington. George Washington impounded funds for ships that he didn't want built for the Navy after money was authorized and appropriated. But this was so blatant and so public, and in the midst of the atmosphere of Nixon accusing Congress of being big spenders, that two things happened. One is that there was a great deal of motivation to pass the Budget and Impoundment Control Act. The impoundment provision, Title 10 of this act, was slapped onto the negotiations that were going on for a new budget process, and they passed very quickly almost unanimously in the House and the Senate, and it's surprising since it was so dramatic in terms of a change on the institution and a change in terms of presidential and congressional relations. Another problem, and then I'll get to some solutions that were established, were the uncontrollables. 85% of the budget today is considered relatively uncontrollable from year to year. What's that mean? It means it takes an act of political suicide in some areas to get control of the budget. It takes someone willing to go to Florida, where there are many retirees, to say, we're going to cut back on the indexing on Social Security, which makes up 21% of the budget. It's the biggest uncontrollable in the budget in the sense that a person's state in society, age, number of quarters that a person has worked, actually influences the distribution of money. It's an entitlement program. But there are many other uncontrollables in the military area. On an average, it takes 8 years to spend out money on contracts. It's more for aircraft carriers, 12 years or so, and less for SOX, it's 1 year. But generally, the average is 8 years. So a decision made this year, unless there's a major political change, a decision this year locks Congress into spending in a curve like this out 8 years, part of the uncontrollables. Congress wanted to do something about this because frequently the authorization committees would authorize programs that would lock the appropriations committees into spending money without any discretion. And the classic of that is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Another one that has come up recently that you all know about is the catastrophic health area. It sort of runs on automatic, and the appropriations committees have little control, theoretically, over it. But you can see that they ultimately do have control, and they did reject the catastrophic health insurance this year with enough pressure. The reforms in the Budget Impoundment Control Act try to do something about all of these problems. Now, you know what they are. Let me go through them very quickly. A House and Senate budget committees were created. Never really had them before except for 1 year in 1950. They tried a joint budget committee. It failed miserably, and they dropped it. And so there was never committees that were overall other committees in terms of establishing expenditures and revenues or revenue estimates. And of course, we all know about revenue estimates. That's the best way to reduce the deficit. If you estimate performance of the economy at a very high rate, you can get more estimates. And we've seen a lot of that lately, and especially this year. I'll get to that in a second. In terms of the so-called blue smoke and mirrors estimates and tricks in the budget, which I'll get into also. So we created these two committees. They're very different, by the way. Senate committee has been, from the very beginning, more bipartisan. Senator Muskie gave up an important seat on foreign affairs to be on the budget committee, to be the first chair. You can build seniority on that committee. You don't have to rotate. In the House of Representatives, the Rules Committee, the Ways and Means Committee and the Appropriations Committees were very worried about another power source. So what do? They put in a rule that called for members to rotate off and on the committee. You can serve no longer than 4 years. So no one can build expertise easily on that committee. So you can be chair for 4 years and then you have to get off, like Bill Gray did from Philadelphia. Secondly, there are 5 automatic members from Ways and Means and 5 automatic members from Appropriations and 5 from the Speaker. Right, it really reduces the power, doesn't it, of this thing. So it's been very partisan, very ideological compared to the Senate committee, and therefore the committee, the budget bills coming out of the House frequently are not as acceptable to the members generally as the bills coming out of the Senate. Another reform was that we created a new budget process and a new fiscal year. The fiscal year started a few days ago on October 1. The idea was that you'd have more time for consideration of the appropriations and budget process. Why? Well, under the law, on November 10th, Congress must receive the current services budget of the United States. The current services budget of the United States simply defines what did it cost to run the government in the previous year. Since budgeting is incremental, the major decision is made on the increment of increase in every program each year, somewhat decremental in the sense that in some programs they've decreased, so they're deciding on the decrease, and it's not zero-based budgeting as Carter thought it was when he had ZBB. It's really on that increment. Then if you know the current services budget, you know where the battles are. So under the law, OMB had to deliver the current services budget November 10th. So you have from November 10th, 1 year, all the way around to October 1st to sort of work on this thing, versus January 15th to July 1. Now there are a series of dates in the budget process that I could go through. I won't. They've all been missed. There have only been 2 years when they passed the budget on time, since 1975 when they first started implementing the law. And if you have questions about that, I can go through the data on that in greater detail. The fiscal year allowed Congress then, theoretically, months more to complete all of its spending and tax legislation. But lo and behold, the will has not been there to finish this work in time. And again, we face the possibility, well, we face delay this year and the possibility of sequestration, which gets into the Redmond Hollings, which I'll speak to in a second. We also had created the Title 10 of the Act, which is the impoundment portion of the Act, which creates 2 forms of impoundment, rescissions and deferrals. Rescissions rescind money permanently for a program. It's a more serious thing, and therefore Congress must act within 45 legislative days to agree with the President on a rescission, or he must spend the money. So about 80% of the rescissions do not pass. Many more did under Reagan because of his skillful leadership and bringing together a coalition of conservative Democrats and Republicans in the House for a few years, but that was an anomaly. Generally, presidents don't succeed on rescissions. Deferrals mean deferring the expenditure of money up to 12 months. They stand unless both houses agree that they shouldn't stand. So generally, about it's flipped. 80% of those monies don't get spent. Deferral monies don't get spent. There are a variety of other reforms. The Congressional Budget Office was created. It has about 250 staff members. The first director was Alice Rivlin. Everybody thought that would be a left-wing Brookings think tank at that point because she came from Brookings. Then Rudy Pinner was selected. He's another economist, but he's from AEI, and everybody thought, oh my gosh, it's going to be a right-wing think tank. And it just hasn't worked out that way. Very professional group, very objective group. Frequently it criticizes the committees of the House and the Senate. It always criticizes the overly optimistic estimates of the President and OMB. And it's been very independent. The director now is Bob Reischauer, comes from Brookings. His father was ambassador to Japan. A very thoughtful, objective individual. The staff has been stable. I did a survey, in fact, in my research for the House of Representatives on the quality of the work of GAO, CBO, Congressional Budget Office, the Congressional Research Service, and the Office of Technology Assessment, and the Congressional Budget Office comes right at the top. Members and staff think that it does by far the best work. Now, I hope I'm not offending anyone who used to be or is with GAO or OTA or some other organization. Okay, so we had this new reform. We were supposed to reduce the deficit. We were supposed to be more responsible. We were supposed to have a better system of control vis-a-vis the president, but what's happened? What's happened is that we've really failed in most of these objectives that we were trying to solve. The debt, as an estimate of adding up all the deficits, and just to give you a little perspective, it was $1.1 trillion the day that President Reagan came into office. It will be approximately $3 trillion within a month. There will be a new debt limit bill that has to be passed. This comes from a conservative man who wanted to balance the budget and do away with the debt. The variety of reasons for this, some of the reasons are clearly on the backs of Democrats and others on the backs of Republicans. It's on everyone's back in terms of the debt and the deficit. Spending priorities, yes. Under the Budget Act, we do set and debate in a macro manner the amount of expenditures in 21 functional categories of the budget, things like defense, education, natural resources, transportation. However, the way it's really done is the way it was done before. Decisions are made around programs. They're added up informally and through staff markups, meaning markups out of sight of the public frequently. The agreements are made and the aggregate amounts in the functional categories are added up by the budget committees, and they simply are agreeing to decisions that have been made in other arenas by the appropriations committees and authorization committees. There has been some discipline, but the discipline has got so bad that in terms of the deficit, that in late 1985, in response to widespread frustration in Congress and the budget deficit, the Congress enacted the, quote, Balanced Budget and Emergency Deficit Control Act, PL 99-177. This is Graham Rudman Hollings, or as my neighbor calls it, Grim Rudman Howlings. What does the Act do? The Act says that originally it was to reduce the deficit to zero within 5 years, and they've stretched that out because they've missed it, and I think they'll stretch it out again, but we'll get into that in a little while. It's a way for Congress to have targets on the deficit each year, and let me give you an example of what those targets should be very quickly. Sorry. They've changed so much that I wanted to have a table in front of me. I don't have it. Bear with me. Let me go on. It's simply... here it is. The targets under the original law were to have a balanced budget or zero deficit by 1991. Graham Rudman II, which was passed a couple of years later, stretched it out to a zero or balanced budget in 1993. Let me give you some of the figures very quickly, give you a sense of how well they've done in terms of meeting the Graham-Rudman projections. In other words, projections versus reality. 1986, they were supposed to have 171.9 in the deficit. The actual deficit was $221 billion. 1987, 144, they hit 149.7. 1988, 108 billion, they hit 155. At that point, they revised the law. And so the revision was to hit 144, but they hit 155 anyway. In 1989, the revision was 136 billion, they hit 161. 1990, that's this year, that's what they're struggling with, is FY 1990, they're supposed to hit 100 billion. The projections vary significantly. The president feels that it'll be 116, CBO thinks it'll be 143, and no one is talking about something that maybe you don't know about, and maybe you do, and that is that they are borrowing about 50 to 60 billion from Social Security. No one really debates this. By law, any surplus in the Social Security Act must go to reduce the deficit, by law. So Phil Graham is going to bring up as one of his reform efforts the suggestion that be changed, that Social Security be really off budget, that the surpluses not be used to reduce the deficit, and he wants to stretch out the balanced budget out to 1999 and without Social Security. What happens if you don't meet these deficit targets? Well, what happens is, and you have to be within a $10 billion range, in other words, you can go $10 billion over. What happens is that there's a process called sequestration, or I like to call it a baloney slicer, or automatic government, taking the responsibility away from our representatives and giving it to this process. I'm very critical of it, as you can tell. What happens is that 50% of the money to be cut to meet the deficit target must come from the military. Now, that's interesting. The military makes up 26% of the budget. 26% of the budget. And again, this is getting very technical, and I'm sorry, but we need to get into the technicalities of it. It means outlays, cuts in outlays. And there's a difference between budget authority each year, that's what is signed into law, and outlays. If you build an aircraft carrier, as I said before, it takes about 12 years or so. The amount of money going out that's authorized takes a long time in this curve of expenditures. And so it's very hard to get control of outlays. But yet you have to control outlays in terms of hitting the target. So let's take the military. 50% of the cuts from military, 26% of the budget. That doesn't seem quite right, but that's the way the law passed. And if you take the military, some people think 75% of the military budget is relatively uncontrollable from year to year. If you want to really cut it, you cut down the troops. Should we bring troops back from Europe? Well, let's say that we do. That takes 2 years. Expenditures go up, and then they go down in terms of shutting out troops. You just don't say, okay, fellas, this is it, and you hit the road in Germany. You've got to bring them home. You've got to muster them out. Many of the military expenditures are not only long-term contracts, but they are salaries, health benefits, housing, a variety of other things, very hard to get a hold of. The other 50% of cuts that must come, and they will come in the next few days, because we will go into sequestration, in my opinion, must come from social programs. But Social Security cannot be touched. That's 21% of the budget. 21% of the budget is sacred. Medicare and Medicaid, two other big pieces of entitlement programs, you can only cut 1% maximum out of those when you're doing sequestration. So where do we go? Do we cut the interest? No, that's 14% of the budget. You can't touch the interest. You can't not pay the bankers in Bonn and Tokyo and London. So where do you go? You go to the parks. You go to the highway administration. You go to places that just don't have a lot of money. They have a lot of people to administer things, and you have to lay off people. Well, it's impossible. So many people feel that it's like deterrence theory, you know, in nuclear warfare, that it just isn't going to happen. But it is going to happen this year, and there are ways around it. Let me go through this a bit. My hypothesis is that they will go into sequestration, and probably non-essential employees will be sent home. That means lawyers. That means my wife. She's a lawyer. They will go home for a few days, and then the Senate and the House will get their act together, and they'll pass a new budget. But under the Graham Rudman Hollings and the rules of the budget process, they can pass a budget that goes beyond the target. And that's what they'll do. And they'll spend money at a higher rate at the very beginning, and they'll probably spend much more money, obviously, than allowed under Graham Rudman Hollings. Plus, they'll do a bunch of other things, which they're already doing. Crazy things, in my opinion. And it's tricks. I'll give you two or three tricks of the trade. One is, and you've read about it, one is that if you don't have enough money for next year, right, to meet the target, what you do is you pay people in last fiscal year. How many of you saw this in the paper, that the military is being paid on the last day of last fiscal year? It saves billions. Saves billions. The deficit goes up significantly for last year, but who cares? You're trying to do a budget for next year. Okay, they've done this, the accounting tricks, this way in a variety of ways, plus they've overestimated performance of the economy. The presidents, Democrats and Republicans have been doing it for years. Now members of the budget committees know how to do it and they love to do it. CBO is very critical and in all their publications criticizes this, but they are estimating more revenues than actually will probably come in. There are a variety of other tricks that are being used, and that will continue. This brings us to the overall issue of governance in the budget process and some questions that I'd like to propose, and then we'll open it up to questions and answers if that's an appropriate thing to do. What's happening here? We have a pluralist system in America where interest groups have a great deal of power and entree into Congress through the committees and have their relationships with the agencies, the so-called iron triangles or policy subsystems, sub-governments. And it's very hard for members to say no. It's very hard to go back to Kansas if you're Senator Dole and say, by the way, I want to balance the budget, so therefore I'm not going to help you get subsidies for the farmers or help the savings and loan industry in the state. No, you do both. You go back to Kansas and you say, I'm going to save the farmers, and I'm going to help your banks. I'm going to bail out the savings and loans, and because it's not your fault, savers. We've got to help here. And I'm going to help with education. I'm going to help with the roads, even though he's a conservative. And also, by the way, I'm going to balance the budget, and we're not going to raise taxes. Well, it's just impossible. Members want to be reelected. We all know that. That's the primary motivation of most members. Very few members are highly ideological and will go down and defeat simply because they believe in a particular thing. That doesn't mean they're dishonest. They just want their jobs. So they're going to deliver what interest groups want, well-organized interest groups, the aged that don't want to pay, some of the aged that don't want to pay for catastrophic health insurance. You saw what they did. They're very responsive. When there's a well-organized interest group, they change. And if you add up the 435 members, all of their districts, all of the interests in those districts, it's reflected in the budget. They don't want to cut their piece of the budget in their committees. No one wants to cut. And President Bush is very clever. He says, read my lips, no new taxes. And he's therefore placed on the agenda of the Democrats the onus of finding money for programs that we want, abatement of drug abuse, either by raising taxes or cutting other programs. Very hard thing to do. He knows that you're not going to cut other programs, so therefore the revenues have to come from someplace. But they don't want to raise taxes, because they no one ever gets elected by raising taxes. So we have this great deadlock in our democracy. We've had it in history from time to time, but we really have a serious one now, and I call it hyperpluralism. Hyperpluralism meaning many groups having a lock on government, and the members not being able to move easily, and being unwilling to lead and educate and go out and get the public to say, listen, if you want all these things, we've got to have more taxes. No one is saying that. Or listen, the aged, you have to cut back a little bit. People going to college, you've got to cut back a little bit. If you want roads, we've got to have the private sector more involved. People are not really doing that as much as they need to if we want to pass this budget on time. There are a series of reforms that are being considered right now before the House and the Senate. I'm glad to talk to you about some of them during the questions and answers, but I think it's appropriate now to open it up to Q&A. Right.
Very clear presentation. Professor Fernbach?
You haven't said anything about going off budget on certain items. What that does to the picture would not be appropriate, for example, for the next day or two for members of Congress to simply take 3 or 4 of the major departments off budget.
Right. they did with the Postal Service, or that's a suggestion. I think they did with the Postal Service. And when you take a department off budget, that means that you're not spending money for that department. And it's a, you know, it's an accounting trick. But you still have the expenditures for that particular department and the revenues from that particular department, Postal Service. It's another trick. There are dozens of tricks.
We've done that with the savings and loans.
Yeah, right. And plus the savings and loan, part of the savings and loan billions of dollars that are being spent are placed in last year's budget. And so we don't have to worry about it, do we? Because that's last year's budget. So, kiddingly, I say from time to time, well, let's just go back 20 years, you know, and just keep putting these expenses back 20 years, back to World War II, you know, and putting them in previous budget years. It's a joke. And then we don't really have to worry about these things, right?
My mother, if she were here, would ask if it's off budget, what budget is it on?
Yeah, right.
Where does it appear? How does it, for the total layman, where?
It becomes a separate item that is called off budget. It has its own budget, and you cannot touch its revenues, and the expenditures there do not become a part of the integrated budget that is discussed on Capitol Hill. Another example of government on automatic, where members are unwilling to face up to their responsibilities as representatives to make hard decisions about revenues and expenditures. But no, it's in a separate document, separate item.
Next question.
Yes,
Howard Crum.
I know that President Reagan complained about not being able to use a line item veto, which many states he claimed did. And I don't see any possibility in your talk that will ever happen because of the vested interests across the United States. So why is it that the states can do it and the nation? What are the factors that permit the governor to get that power?
Well, let's discuss it at the federal level. It would take a constitutional amendment to have the line item veto, or it would take an act of Congress. Now, if you were in Congress, would, even if you were a Republican and there was a Republican president, would you want to give the president the power to go through and draw a pencil through two or three or five or six items out of 100 items in an appropriations bill? No, There's no coalition in Congress to do that. The states really don't have it, and so therefore there isn't a movement in the states to do a constitutional amendment. So therefore there are a couple of other reforms that I'd like to mention that would have the same effect that are being discussed. One is the enhanced rescission authority. Now, rescissions and deferrals in a way are line item vetoes, but they take the president's action, the president can go through and say, okay, we will have no more money for the development of germ warfare at Edgewood Arsenal, Maryland. I mean, you can be that specific, but it takes a message to Capitol Hill. And the rescission, in other words, doing away with it permanently, takes an act of Congress, okay? And Congress doesn't act quickly on anything. So the idea is, in the enhanced rescission authority, it would permit the rescission to become effective automatically, and it would take an act of Congress to disagree with it. Now, since it's very hard to get Congress to act on anything, that puts the power with the president. So that is being discussed. I don't think it's going anywhere, but there are quite a few members that would find that more palatable than a line item veto. The other one, quickly, is the enhanced deferral authority, where he could withhold funds much more easily for a longer period than 1 year. I won't go through the details of that, but it's another little trick in Title 10 of the Budget and Public Control Act that gives him more power. And I've said from the very beginning, he really has the line item veto with rescissions and deferrals. It's just a matter of how much power he has vis-a-vis Congress. So.
Yes, Mr. Siebert.
With all the problems you've described, is a constitutional amendment to balance the budget of practicality?
It certainly has been discussed. I think that the height of its popularity was at the beginning of the Reagan administration, probably 3 years into the administration, and it's waned significantly in terms of support on Capitol Hill. There are always a dozen bills introduced to in Congress, but they go nowhere. As you know, 15,000 bills are introduced in each Congress, and about 400 of them see the light of day. So, you know, you introduce them for a variety of reasons. But it's going nowhere at this point. Is it practical? That depends upon your philosophy of governance. I don't think that it's a good idea. It would be unfair. And you get this sort of snowballing until you end up with discretionary programs, which are about 15% of the budget, and defense. I just think that it wouldn't work, or that there would be so many loopholes to get out of it that it would just be a symbolic vote to have it in the first place. If you did have it without any loopholes, with the controllability, the uncontrollability of the budget, there wouldn't be much for people to do. And so I don't think members would go along with this. In other words, with 85% of the budget is uncontrollable, balanced budget amendment, the 15% would have to be used to get it to balance immediately, and we'd have recession and, you know, a variety of other things, and you couldn't use government to stimulate the economy and a variety of other things, in my opinion. Yes? Sorry.
General Disney. In view of the weaknesses you outlined, the uncontrollable tricks, motivations that give human character in our political system, whatever can we do to do, or do we have to resign ourselves to unbalanced budgets forever? I mean, are there any things that give some hope of correcting the situation?
Well, I think what we need to do is use the electoral process to put pressure on the members to give them will to do something about it. Americans generally don't care about the deficit. Maybe some Americans do on Wall Street from time to time, and maybe some in the business community do from time to time. But generally, Americans don't care. And if you want members to care about it, you have to give them the will to act. And the way to give them the will to act is to give them a clear message through their electoral process by having people defeated that say one thing in the district and do something else in Congress. That's quite abstract and philosophical, but it comes down to grassroots pressure to do something. They will not balance this budget unless it'll stretch out like taffy, in my opinion, and go for many years, unless Americans say, enough, do something about this now. The other idea that is floating around is everyone, starting with Stockman and before, has said the deficit man is going to get you, right? This is this awful thing. Nothing's happened. We've had over 80 months of growth. It's unprecedented since World War II. 80 months of growth in America. It's very prosperous for most Americans. The problem is that if we go into a recession, there's no bullets left. You can't drop taxes to stimulate the economy. We've done it. You can't increase government expenditures to stimulate the economy easily because we've done it.
So was Proposition 13 a success? That was a voters' revolt, if you like. And I understand it started off fine and then it fizzled.
Right. I don't know that much about it. I can't really answer because I haven't studied it. I'm sorry. It seems like it was at the beginning, but I'm sorry. I just don't know.
Henry Thielbaum.
We've talked about the expenditure side, and the other important side is the revenue. In terms of forecasting, what would be the possibility, or is it just remote, that the value-added tax could be put in place, which would make the forecasting much more precise?
That's been, the VAT has been discussed. It was more popular a few years ago on Capitol Hill than it is now. It seems that they want to continue to cut taxes. Capital gains is an example at this point. Certainly the VAT would allow more accurate forecasts. Problem with forecasts generally, in my opinion, is that it's like a Tower of Babel. Every unit has a different forecast in terms of revenue.
Well, that would be the point of having a VAT.
Right, it would help you be more accurate. I agree with that. I don't think it's going anywhere. It's not being actively discussed. In preparation for this meeting today, I've talked to people at the Congressional Budget Office, and from that interview have a list of 30 reforms that are being actively considered, and it is not one of them. But one on the revenue side that was interesting to me, listen to this one, is that if you go into sequestration, one reform that is being actively debated is that you should include revenues as well as expenditures. In other words, you go into sequestration, instead of automatic cuts only, you have automatic tax increases. Now that would really be automatic government, because then you could go back to Kansas and say, gee, you had a tax increase, but it's not my fault. It's Graham Rudman Hollings. They made us do it. I was against it, but they made us do it because we went through sequestration and we had an automatic tax increases. And obviously liberal Democrats would like to have this passed, and I think it will be debated with the debt limit bill.
Yes, Bill.
I remember some years ago when Chrysler Corporation was struggling. Lee Iacocca became president, and he managed to work the thing out with a great deal of difficulty. And he had a phrase which I think was very apt then, and that was equality of sacrifice. And he promoted this, that everybody had to give up something, including himself, the president.
Right.
I sense that there's the problem in this instance is that there is no constituency for sacrifice. What small constituency there is powerless. And so we try to resort to automatic things. It's not my fault, it's the system.
Right.
And I'm wondering, in that arsenal of weapons, if we look down the road and say, well, why nothing's happened as the deficit has grown. Nothing's happened as our debt load has grown. So why worry? And from time to time we see in the papers, the economists say, don't worry, it's related to the total gross national product OGP.
Even Brookings economists are saying this right now, right?
So, and yet all of us know that, that if you extend these lines, that at some point there will be a reaction, and the economies and interest rates and currency exchange rates have a way of overshooting, going on much longer than people say they ought to, and then fall off the cliff. I'm wondering if you want an automatic thing, why don't we index taxes to the interest burden of the debt?
Interesting.
So the more deficit we have, the tax rate goes. That'll call the debt, the accumulated debt, to their attention.
Right. Then they become more sensitive. That's a clever idea. Let me add to that some facts, okay, related to your statement. One is the question of debt as percent of GNP. If you take debt $1.1 trillion to $3 trillion, it sounds like a heck of a lot of money. Generally in Washington, we don't worry about $1 trillion. It's like a theological concept. It's so large that some people believe in and some people don't, like God. Right? But a lot of other people do worry about it, and they put it in terms of GNP. Let me give you some figures as percent of GNP. I won't bore you, but I just want to give you the trend here. Debt held by the public, total debt, as percent of GNP in 1988 was 42.9. In 1989, 42.7. 1990, 42.8. projected 1991, 42.6. It's about 42 all the way out. Deficit, that's the lack of money each year as percent of GNP. 3.2% actual in 88, 3.1 in 89, 2.6 in 90, 2.5 in 91, 2.3 in 92, 2.1 in 93, and 1.8 in 94 projections. Of course, the projections are a little questionable. The deficit in debt as percent of GNP has been stable over the last 15 years. And so this is where the economists are getting their argument, is that, gee, you know, our economy is growing like mad. We're producing much more. It's richer. We can have, in total number of dollars, more debt. But as long as the percent of GNP, deficit in debt stays fairly level. With respect to equal suffering, interesting idea. One thing that is being proposed is a, quote, pay-as-you-go approach to the budget. Any increase in outlays from the previous year's base level, that means the current services budget, what it took the government to work last year, must be paid by offsetting outlay reductions or tax increases. Now, let me explain in English. That means that if you want something new, the next year, from the base, you got to take it from someplace else, or you got to increase taxes. That's a very, very interesting idea. I don't think the members are going to adopt it because it's just too tough. That's what they're supposed to be doing each year. If you follow the 86 Tax Reform Act, that's what they did in the 84 Tax Reform Act in the Senate, is they said every amendment that we're going to consider on the floor for increasing tax expenditures, in other words, reducing taxes, must come from someplace else in the bill. It became a zero-sum game. That's what you're talking about. And so all of a sudden, only about 6 amendments passed the Senate rather than 300. Because if you wanted a depletion allowance for oil companies, you had to take it from the real estate people, right? And the real estate people are well organized as well as the oil companies. So all of a sudden, the bill moved with only a few amendments. Now, that's basically what you're suggesting for the whole system. Some people are debating it, but I don't think very seriously. Not a good question. Good comment.
Bill Wendell.
Would you comment on a slightly different view of the catastrophic catastrophe? And that is
and I can give you names of others. It was a case of a violent uprising, which was successful, it appears, against what was seen as a discriminatory income surtax on old people. That was the main point. It wasn't just a general unwillingness to pay for something. It was the idea of raising income taxes as taxes against old people as a class. And in spite of the, what is it, 30 million member AARP and all those other, it went down in flames. They had no ability to control their constituency. Now, the problem is, I think, that shows that you can have a constituency by popular initiative, not by organizations and interest groups. And I, of course, recognize the real problem is how can you get such a self-starting constituency to get Congress to get a real control of the budget and spending?
Comment on on catastrophic. There are a variety of interpretations. Some would disagree with your interpretation. So let me respectfully present another position, which I'm sure you've heard, and that is that, well, first of all, certainly the AARP did not represent it the most active element of its constituency in calling for this particular tax to pay for catastrophic health. Members, Ross Minkowski is one of them, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, simply say that it is a very narrow, fairly wealthy, well-organized and articulate group within the aged that lobbied very effectively to have this defeated. That two-thirds of the aged live below the poverty line, and this was a redistribution program that people didn't want. It was redistributing money from more wealthy aged individuals to less wealthy individuals in retirement, and the more wealthy individuals are more well organized and focused on Congress and effectively defeated this. They feel that on fixed incomes that the general revenue should pay for this. I think that probably the one-third of the aged that we're going to pay for the cost of the two-thirds would say, yes, we don't want our colleagues to suffer, to die, because there is lack of funds, because this is life and death to some people. But it should come from general revenues. It should be people that are in the workforce that should pay for this, not people who had planned and for retirement, have a certain income that they know they're going to have, and all of a sudden they're hit with this tax. That's the argument, and some people are pretty bitter about it, by the way, on Capitol Hill. They're saying, okay, we're not going to do anything for the aged anymore on catastrophic because we've been burned on this one. You just take care of yourself. Well, I don't believe it. I think the aged are well organized, the most well organized constituency in the history of humankind.
What were they?
Well, I think this was a true grassroots firestorm.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. And your question, to get to your question, is how...
said a lot of people don't understand this, and we've been writing our congressman and the president
right.
handwritten letters, not this stuff you've seen lately.
Right. It was a firestorm. Now, how can you do that around the budget? You can't. Because if you live in the Palouse in eastern Washington and you've got subsidies for winter wheat farming, you want winter wheat subsidies, you want the canals, you want the locks on the Snake River and the Columbia River to get the wheat out of there, you want trade, all of this stuff costs money. So there may be a firestorm against saving, against expenditures in something else, but not in my area. And you take that times every one of the 435 congressional districts, and you can't find a common coalition for a firestorm to get people to balance the budget, because people don't want the budget balanced.
Yeah, they want it balanced for everybody else.
Yeah, right.
Yes, Mars.
You did get the firestorm. What did Congress then do? The firestorm, overwhelming demand that the deficit be stopped and the debt be reduced. What did Congress do?
Well, they'd have to cut back on Social Security. They'd have to cut back on defense expenditures. They'd have to probably withdraw some troops, ground troops in Europe. They'd have to get out of Korea. You know, I'm just thinking of...
They'd have to raise taxes.
Have to raise taxes.
What would that do to the economy?
Right. Boom.
Yes. Isn't that the problem?
Well, they certainly don't want to be associated with causing a recession, and presidents don't, because that's how you elect and defeat presidents, is primarily performance of the economy. And war and peace. And so everybody's a little nervous because they like their jobs. They like Washington.
If you raise taxes and the economy booms, you're not going to collect the taxes. You're going to get less taxes.
If the economy goes down.
The economy goes down.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You're gonna collect less taxes.
And that's the theory behind capital gains. Drop for 2 years as you stimulate activity, get more revenues. But, you know, on this one, I'm wondering who's going to buy. You know, they say, okay, let's have capital gains drop so people will sell stocks and bonds, but also real estate. But who's going to buy the real estate if the capital gains goes back up in 2 years? And it will, and it'll be indexed. You've got to have buyers as well as sellers. And so I don't quite understand this, but I'm not an economist, so, yeah.
Professor Fernbach.
It's already been forecast that if that passes, there will be a drop in the stock market. There's a lot of people will sell.
Right.
And that will be a factor. There will be a drop in the real estate market because there'll be more sellers than buyers.
Exactly.
And so on. So you've got some real questions there. What hasn't been mentioned is that how do we stay afloat? We stay afloat because we've got a lot of foreign capital coming in. Come in if we keep our interest rates high, or at least high enough to do it, which in turn has adverse effects in terms of long-term growth.
Sure. The 50% of the Treasury bills are purchased by foreigners over the last 4 or 5 years, as you know. It's the United States is. It's not only interest rates; it's safe. It's a good, safe place. To invest, the Japanese want to invest here because they want this engine to continue because they have an export economy. And they're primarily exporting to the United States. They have to sell the junk they make, pardon me, to us, and so they don't want the economy to go down either. So they'll continue to buy. Now, the question is, how do we grow out of this? We grow out of it by having better educated people. And a workforce that increases productivity, and I don't see us going in that direction.
May I follow up on this, though? It seems to me that you get to a situation in which, as with individuals, the come down hurts, and it is going to hurt. I don't see any way in which you can tell the congressman or the president can tell people to find a way to do it, which doesn't hurt. And the longer you wait, the longer it hurts.
Right.
I could have a great time if I could simply grab my checkbook and write a $2 million check to the Miller Center, first of all.
We accept.
And then, you know, go out and buy two or three yachts. And
right.
So forth. At some point, someone's going to catch me.
That's right. Or someone has to pay. Now, the way I put this is that, gee, my kid's college education is costing so much money. Let them pay it. You know, give it to the next generation because we've spent so much on them in this generation. But that's a joke. The next generation is certainly going to have to pay, but I think we have to pay too, and we have to pull on our belts and be a little more conservative about things. And I don't see it because you don't get elected doing that. We had a presidential candidate, Mondale, that ran and said, hey, we've got to stop this. He sounded like a Republican we've got to stop this. And by the way, we've got to have a tax increase. If you want all these things, and the polls always show that you want all these things in the budget, we've got to have a tax increase. Well, did he win? No. Does anybody win saying that? No. They don't win saying things like that. And so our form of democracy, this hyper-pluralist democracy, creates a situation where members know what they need to do but don't do it because they want to get reelected, in my opinion.
At the state level, we do win occasionally with an increase in taxes.
It depends on where you're coming from on the base, though, frequently on that. And I think that many Americans perceive our rate to be right at the limit nationally.
Very short questions, or we'll go beyond our limit. Mr. Siebert, Mr. Cromwell, and Mr. Yonke.
Just a comment on the stock market. When the Tax Reform Act of 1986 went into effect, it eliminated capital gains, and we thought the stock market would have an effect on the stock market, but the stock market did absorb that and went ahead. The elimination of capital gains had no effect. If it did have an effect, it wasn't felt, it was absorbed, and there was a positive reaction.
Well, that's in large part because such a major part of the market is tax-free. That's the one thing that, in forecasting the decline, I think you have to take into account the colossal market effect of the tax-free investment.
Thank you. All of the tax-free bonds. Yeah.
Well, no, I'm thinking about the pension funds.
Pension funds. Oh, yes, yes, right.
And a very large part of the total market is made up of the tax-free people. And I have some considerable question as to whether or not there would be a massive decline, because the sellers would be selling right into the pension funds, which would have a bonanza.
And it would drop slightly. They would buy stock and absorb it. Yeah. The pension funds make up, what, about 35% of the portfolio?
Yes, but on a very large part of the activity.
Right.
Much more than that in terms of
And they're getting involved in all of these takeover and things, it seems, some of them, which I find very questionable.
I do too. Anyway. But I think as a market force, that is highly important, as is the foreign investor.
Right.
So you have a cushion there, and I think you can oversimplify the matter of the effect of the change.
I used to work for Hubert Humphrey. You didn't mention that because you didn't want people to be biased in their opinions of me. He used to call economists witch doctors or theologians, and that's the way I sort of feel about all of these things and these predictions, but I think you're generally right.
I'm like a pseudo-economist.
You're still a pretty good one. Victor Yonke.
Professor Ferber, what's really disturbed me in recent years is this philosophy of debt is only a percent of the gross national product, and that is really something which I really don't buy. Because if we get into a recession, I don't think it's debt, but when.
Right.
The deficit and the debt are going to be inversely increased. That's really going to accept our acceptability of bonds and securities and overseas.
Right. And people immediately withdraw from the market and go elsewhere. And I agree with you. I just wanted to present that position and give you the figures on deficit and debt. And even people like Henry Aaron, moderate economist friends of mine at Brookings, are basically, they're citing this now, and they're saying, hey, we don't really have to worry about it. But I don't see any bullets left in our ammunition. If we go into a recession, we can't drop taxes easily, we can't increase government expenditures, possibly Keynesian way to get the economy going again. So I agree with you. I'm concerned too. But you can't win elections doing that. I mean, you can't go out and say, gee, something's going to happen terrible, you know, either a month from now or 2 years or 3 years from now, we've got to do something. It just doesn't appeal to people.
Final question, Howard Cromwell.
I want to know from your experience, has there been a change in the schedule, timing, when the budget must come to the business desk, so he is not put in the position that if you don't sign this, with some of these sweetheart deals in there that he didn't contemplate, you'll paralyze the government. It'll just come to a halt. There'll be no money to run it. And has there been any change in the Bush administration that he will get the budget early enough so he can veto it and still can go back and they'd be forced to take out some of these amendments that he disagrees with violently?
Well, first of all, the budget itself is only a document when it's passed in its entirety that applies to Congress. He doesn't sign a law called the budget. The budget arrives in the old way to the president in 13 separate appropriations bills and a series of authorization bills that authorize the program. So has there been a change in law or procedure, and has there been a change in behavior with respect to getting these things to the president? There hasn't been a change in behavior at all. I mean, we've seen that this year. We're late in getting the appropriations bills to him, and he can still, you know, veto it, and the government will go down in a particular area if he vetoes it, and we're into the next fiscal year, or they'll do a CR, continuing resolution, in the area, as they did before. Secondly, has there been a change in procedure? Yes, under the Act of 74, all of these bills were to have been passed by September 25th. They've only met that deadline twice since 1975 in terms of Congress getting all of the bills up there in time for the president to consider them before the next fiscal year, October 1st. So I hope that answers your question. You probably didn't want to hear it, but
I think all of you know that Fred Barnes, who was to have been our speaker on the 19th, has changed to the 26th. I believe you got that notice, but wanted to be sure you did. We've had a good illustration of why our speaker has won all these awards. If anybody can make the dismal science interesting, why, he must be a great teacher. So we thank you very much.